Good afternoon. So, last time we talked briefly about barriers, which were a super specialized way of syncing up between threads to handle the case where we wanted every other thread to wait for every other thread. And we found that that pattern happens often in things that look like simulations, which is why it was worthwhile having this, single purpose synchronization construct. And we saw that POSIX implemented one. And we mentioned it early, partly, so you could start the life assignment, which is due this week, and you don't have to use barriers to do the life assignment, but it's almost certainly the easiest way of doing the assignment. Then we talked about locking again. We had spin locks already, and we had disabling interrupts to do locks in a single core, but we wanted locks that actually integrated with a scheduler. Because spin locks were really dissatisfying in that they meant that we would have to wait a long time doing nothing useful, just trying to get the spin lock, when we could be writing something more useful. So we had an alternative idea for locks where we'd make something not runnable while it was waiting for the lock, but this meant that our unlock operation became more complicated and now needs to make that thing runnable again. And to make this work, we need to have some sort of integration with the scheduler so we have a way of making things runnable and not runnable without running into other race conditions. So then we talked about monitors, starting with condition variables, which are this very general synchronization construct. So they're going to allow us to pretty much do any sort of I want threads to wait at this time operation we want to do, unlike barriers where we had to like choose a specific thing, or locks where there's one pattern they handled. And we have these condition variables, which are very poorly named, which are basically just an interface around a queue of threads waiting for something. So they're just the interface to access that queue. You can put yourself on the queue, and you can remove threads from the queue and add them to the list of runnable threads. And these always are used in combination with a lock, so hence this concept of a monitor. So we have a lock protecting some shared data, we have a condition that's related to that shared data, and our operation to wait on a condition variable is coordinated with this lock, so we unlock the lock when we start waiting, and we relock the lock when we continue waiting. Because it's coordinated with this, we don't have to worry about what if I, start waiting, but just the millisecond before I start waiting, the condition I'm waiting for changes. That's not possible because the operation of starting waiting happens simultaneously with unlocking that lock. So the condition can't change until we start waiting. And we called this combination of that shared data protected by that lock, so we know what doesn't change at unsafe times, condition variable, a monitor. So questions about what we covered last time? Okay, so some brief notes on the life assignment. So if you took COA 2, which is the pilot computer organization and architecture course, that is in the new piloted curriculum, you should know who you are. You have an additional requirement for the life assignment and an additional requirement for the pool assignment. This is because in COA 2, there's an assignment which is extremely similar to the life assignment, so you don't get to, have that practice for free. We want you to do a little extra. Also, there are sanitizer versions that we build. So these are sanitizers, are these compiler integrated tools that find common errors. This semester, unlike previous ones, have the script building a thread sanitizer, TSAN shorthand, which hopefully finds race conditions. It doesn't find every race condition because it requires you to execute something that exposes the race condition, but it should be pretty good, and hopefully if you actually use this, it will reduce the number of students who submit code which still has race conditions for especially the next assignment. I'm not so concerned for life. It did turn out that the sanitizers test script I submitted with the life assignment didn't work because I had the names of my solution testing binaries and not the ones you'll actually use. So there's an update for that, and I sent an announcement. So just brief notes on the life assignment. Now, let's go on talk about monitors more. And I mentioned monitors, like you can pretty much implement anything. So let's talk about implementing barriers with monitors. So I want a one-use barrier. So here I have my partial implementation of a one-use barrier. I have a lock. I have a total number of threads, which would be set by our equivalent of barrier init, which I am not showing for space. And I'm keeping track of a number reach the barrier. So the question is, I need something else in this struct to represent the barrier, and I need some code here, and I'll correct a not very minor error that this should be barrier number reached, not just random global variable called number reached. So question is, what goes in the blanks? So check with your neighbor. Look, yeah, and this is, I'll write it out so it's clearer. It should be barrier number reached. Just. So can someone get me started on something I'm going to need in some of these blanks? Okay, over back there.
Condition variable, barrier.
So you want a condition variable, okay? So we'll just call it CV. There might be, this probably a bad name, but we don't know what it's used for. Yet, so that's, I agree, something that would definitely be useful because we have to wait for something. And the thing we have to wait for is, so this is going to be one of the threads need to wait for everyone else. For everyone to, reach the barrier. Because that's what we know we need to wait for. So, how am I going to use this condition variable to wait? I told you this condition variable is to wait for everyone else to reach the barrier. So what should the code that uses that condition variable to wait look like? And is there any? No. Okay.
If number reaches the total thread.
So you're saying we should do if I'll abbreviate num reached equals total, and these are of course actually barrier colon total, then what? We want to do, so there's a cond wait operation, and that's going to need the CV and the lock. And this is going to be barrier throughout, everywhere. Just haven't written that down everywhere. Okay, so everyone like that should be there? So I see some heads shaking. Why are people shaking their heads about me writing that there?
Oh, wait, yeah.
So back there? Yeah.
Don't you need like a while loop?
Okay, so one issue is we have this spurious wake-up problem, so we need a while loop. That is, yes, indeed a problem. And we want to wait while, yes, it's not equal. So that's another problem. So you want to wait until it, while it's not equal, which means we're not ready, you want to wait. So anything else that we have complaints about? Okay. No one? Okay. Yeah? So you say we need a broadcast. So you want to put it at the end of the while loop? Outside of the while loop. Okay. So what do you mean by outside?
Outside after the while loop.
Okay. So you're saying that you want to have a cond broadcast here. Okay. And why do we need that? So what's going to happen when we run this is that, let's say we have two threads. We're going to have one thread start waiting because its num reach is going to be 1, the total is going to be 2, it starts waiting. The second thread comes along, they're equal, it doesn't wait at all, it calls cond broadcast, then the first thread wakes up. It realizes, oh, now their totals are equal, and it calls con broadcast again, but that second con broadcast doesn't do anything. So I think that this is a correct solution, but some of you may observe, wait, we're broadcasting maybe a little more than we need to, so there is actually a way we could avoid that, which would be a little cleaner. So I should have made a separate slide for this. So my solution would be if num reached equals total, then broadcast, I won't write out the full code, else while num reached doesn't equal total wait. So that's what my solution would look like to avoid broadcasting twice. So broadcasting extra times, not going to harm anything because we always double check the condition. Okay, so questions about that? I'm sorry for handwriting. Yeah.
Can you explain why this solution broadcasts more than the other one?
So why is this solution broadcast more than the other one? So if we have two threads, we're going to call broadcast twice. And here, if I have two threads, I call broadcast once. And answer your question? Other questions? So this is a one-use barrier, so extending this to more than one use is actually a little tricky and not something we'll do. But let's do a different exercise of a rather different kind of problem. So let's say I'm going to start with producer consumer and say, instead of having this consume, I want to have a consume two. So a consume two is going to get a pair of values, and it's going to wait for both of the pair to be available. So as long as there's only one value, we want to keep wait. So how do I modify this code to turn this consume into a consume two? So, preferably someone who has it. So, what? Give me some adjustment I should make.
Would we put the while loop in a for loop?
So, you're saying make this while loop into a for loop?
No. Nest the while loop inside of a for loop that loops twice.
Okay. So, you're saying to consume two, what I'm going to do is have a for loop, you know, around here that loops twice. Does anyone have any complaints about that? Anyone think there might be an issue? So I think, like, so this seems reasonable if, like, only one thread was calling consume. Maybe not the most efficient thing you could do, but definitely reasonable. But I have some big problems with this if we have two threads calling consume at the same, consume two at the same time. Someone tell me, like, why would I have some problems with that? Yeah?
I still have a problem where, like, if the produce thing signals that the data is ready, both threads grab one item each and accidentally not grab both.
Yeah, so our problem is, I guess I didn't eliminate where the for loop is, but, you know, say we grab both items each time, that assuming that we have this for loop where we grab the first item, then wait for and grab the next item, if we have two threads doing that, both threads can grab their first item and never get a second item, so they'll both wait forever. But presumably the point of having a consume two is that we want to, like, simultaneously take both of them off the queue. So, you know, this is perhaps, I didn't specify the problem precisely enough, because it's not actually obvious that it's wrong for them to keep waiting, but I want it to be the case that they both go simultaneously off the queue, because the reason I'm doing this instead of just calling consume twice is that I want to, you know, to not have a stall if there are exactly two things on the queue. I want one thread to get those. You know, get a pair, rather than having two threads get half of a pair and just wait for a while to complete that pair. So, someone have an alternate idea in mind for how I could deal with that? Yeah?
Could we change the while condition to while there's one thread in the
buffer? Okay, so you're saying, okay, let's change this while condition to while the buffer has less than or equal to one thing. And then we also have to, you know, item one and item two, and return both of the item one, both of the items together. So yeah, that's the solution I have. It's just, you know, just change the condition. Right now we're waiting while the buffer's empty. We don't want to wait while the buffer's empty. We want to wait while the buffer doesn't have enough for us. And enough is not zero, one item, which is why we're checking while the buffer's empty. Enough is, you know, less than two items, or one or less item. So this gives us code like this. Now, there's something that wasn't mentioned, is that we might want to signal at a different time. So if I didn't change how I signaled, it's still correct because I want to wake up as oft, at least, you know, in all those cases, plus there's some extra ones we're signaling in the original code. Here I've changed the code to only signal if I know there's a possibility someone will be able to run. I'm still signaling maybe more often than I need to, but that's probably not a huge deal. So questions about this solution? Yeah.
What if we have two threads and one thread finishes the checking the while loop at the same time the other thread finishes, or right before the second thread finishes the while loop check as well? So they both pull item off the list.
So the question is, what if two threads are calling consume two?
Yes.
At the same time? So one thread is going to say, OK, I woke up from calm wait, and buffer.size is 2. It's going to pull two items off the buffer. And before it releases the lock, buffer.size is going to be less than 2. So when the other thread gets the lock and checks what's buffer.size, there's not going to be any confusion, even if both are woken up. So an example where both are woken up that you might have been worried about with this example is like, what if I have three items? So I push, I produce to go up to 1, then 2, then 3, so I signal twice. Is that what you were concerned about? So indeed, in that case, we'll wake up two threads running consume 2, possibly. But one of them, when they wake up and check again, is there enough stuff in the buffer? We'll find out, no, there isn't, because that other consume 2 got rid of them. Okay, that answer question. Other questions? That's a good scenario to go through. So another thing we could have done is I said we were going to replace consume with consume 2. We could have provided both. Though then there's a question here, and we're going to get to this later, of, wait, if both consume and consume 2 are running, what's going to happen? In this case, what we're saying is whoever wakes up first and gets the lock, which maybe isn't a satisfying solution, but at least we're not doing anything silly. And you can see this general pattern of I just like took this solution and the original code and basically combined them together. Now I have two conditioned variables. And I have something which works, except I haven't made a choice whether consume 2 or consume happens first. I'm just saying whatever wakes up, whatever gets run first by the scheduler wins, rather than making an actual choice. Okay, so how about a third exercise? So here's our producer consume code, and let's say I'm not happy with how my condition variables work. Because we know that if some thread starts waiting and another thread runs consume at the exact right moment, it can sneak in, we learned, before the thread that wakes up gets to run. So we saw that that was sometimes a possibility when we don't have horror scheduling, when we don't have signal hand off the lock, which we learned was typically the case. But, and also we know that consignal, I told you it wakes up a thread. It doesn't necessarily wake up a thread that's chosen the way you want to choose it. So let's say we want to make a stronger guarantee that our condition variable implementation doesn't. That first thing that started consume, and started waiting first, runs first. How can we modify this to do that? And I will note that my solution involves an extra data structure. It is not a small amount of code. It's not, I wouldn't say it's complicated, but, it involves, a lot of extra data structures and storage. Someone give me, you can check with your neighbor, see if you have ideas. What can we do to guarantee If you started waiting first, you run first, despite the fact that our condition variables don't provide this service for us. That they're sloppy, they have might have other ideas about what should run first. Okay, someone have some sort of high-level idea for how we could guarantee this order? I'm not looking for like a worked-out solution, just like, what's your high-level, like, what's the, you know, sort of high-level view of like how this might work with condition variables? I would like to look for someone who hasn't gone talked yet, but maybe I won't get one. Okay, then. So you're saying we should just have a queue of what threads should go. And that is exactly the idea that I used. Now, the question is, if we have a queue of threads, how do we choose how do we represent a thread on that queue that we can wake up when the only tool we have are condition variables? And my answer to that is going to be my queue is going to have a condition variable for each thread on it. So I'm going to make a queue of just a condition variable and a are we done variable. And each thread's going to allocate its own thing to put on the queue. And we just get one thread's structure, one thread's condition variable off the queue, and we wake up exactly that thread. So we're still using consignal, but we don't care that consignal like chooses between threads in a way we don't like, because there's only one thread for it to choose. It can't get it wrong. And so my consume code is, you know, as long if the buffer's empty and or there are other people waiting, add myself to the list of people to wait for. And the produce code is wake up someone who's waiting. But rather than waking up anyone with consignal, we choose exactly which thread to wake up by getting a condition variable that is only for that thread. So questions? On this code. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, why do I need the mutex lock and unlock? So one thing is I'm missing a pthread mutex unlock here. I should have put a dot, dot, dot at the end of produce too. The reason we need that is, well, we have this shared data structure, waiters. And we need to ensure that only one thread at a time manipulates that, or else we get confused about when things are on it. So that's what the lock is for, is to make sure we have... We need that in order to make sure we aren't having two threads manipulating waiters. We also need it because we're checking if buffer is empty. We need to know that between the time we check if the buffer is empty and when we add ourselves to waiters, that the buffer doesn't have something added to it. So we need to prevent produce from running, and produce is going to hold that lock while it's adding things to the queue, so to prevent that.
Okay, so part two of my question would be, parameters if we need to go to the wait state until after we lock the lock. Oh, because there's an unlock over produce.
Yeah. So produce, yeah, produce should have a lock and unlock, which I'm sorry, the lock is in the dot, 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 but I should have added the dot, dot, dot at the end to represent, yeah, we have some extra, we have the same bookkeeping there. Because it is important that produce doesn't try to check the list of waiters while it's being changed. That's a good, yes. Question is, there's a condition variable for every waiter in the queue? Yes. So, like, doesn't this waste a lot of resources? And, like, this is not very efficient, yes. It's not a very satisfying solution. It's probably reasonably efficient. And the reason it's not very satisfying is you say, wait, doesn't the condition variable have a queue inside it? Yeah. So we're like kind of re-implementing what the condition variable does with another condition with more condition variables. So probably this is not the most efficient thing you could do. If you had the same tools that were used to implement condition variables, you should be able to get this to work faster. But if you don't, condition variables are powerful enough to do whatever you want, which is the main reason I had this exercise, is to point out that, you know, worst case, you can choose exactly what thread runs when. You have that capability. It's not particularly, you know, clean or efficient, but you have that capability if you really want it with condition variables. It's a good enough tool, but, you know, you probably usually like to take advantage of the fact that condition variables can handle multiple threads on one condition variable if you can. Okay. Other questions about condition variables? Okay, so talked a bunch about monitors. I'm going to talk about a different kind of tool which is going to support waiting for threads to do things, and this is semaphores. So semaphores are going to be an object which contain a non-negative integer value. So by non-negative, I mean 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. But never a negative number. And they have two operations, and both of these operations have a whole lot of names depending on whose book you're reading or documentation. So there's a P, also known as down, also known as wait operation, which waits for the semaphore to become positive, that is greater than zero, then decrements it. The intuition is, why don't we decrement it immediately if it's zero? Because it has to be non-negative. So we wait for the decrement to actually be possible, then we decrement. And there's a V, or up, or signal, or post operation, which increments the semaphore by one, and this might have the side effect of waking up a thread that was waiting for the semaphore to become positive. So I've shown you all these names. I'm going to mostly use down or wait or up and post. I think down and up are the easiest names to think about semaphores with. Wait and post are the names that POSIX uses. So when I have POSIX-like code snippets, I'm going to show you wait and post because that's the name you have to use if you're using writing code with POSIX to use semaphores. The P and V names are the original ones from Dutch, because this was actually something that Dijkstra's group did way back. He wasn't just an algorithms person, he was one of the pioneers of operating systems and concurrency. So questions about these operations. Okay. So we have these operations, and these are the operations you use to manipulate a semaphore. In particular, you do not read or write the integer contained in the semaphore directly, except when you're creating it. When you're creating it, yeah, you can set it to a number, but otherwise, you should not read or write it directly. There might be some way of doing this in some semaphore implementations you'll see. For example, POSIX has a semGetValue function. It is very, very unlikely that if you're using that for anything but debugging, that your code is correct. Just because it doesn't like lock the semaphore, so the value you get could change at a moment's notice. So you should just think of it as after you initialize, these are the operations you use to access the semaphore, nothing else. And it's never, ever negative. Keep it. So I've given you this very abstract view of what semaphores are. And a natural question from the abstract view is, why are these useful for things I actually want to do in my programs? So let's go through sort of a real-world motivated example. Let's think of a library book. Now, our semaphore holds a number, and I'll use that number to represent how many copies we have of the library book in our library. And if we're taking a book out of the library, we're decrementing that number of copies, and we have to wait for the number of copies to be positive. We can't decrement, go take a book out of the library if the library has no copies right now. So that's our down operation, is reserving a book from this library, and returning it adds one copy for the library, so that's our up operation. And our down operation waits, so when we reserve a book, it's going to wait until there's a copy before we got our book. So you think of the semaphore tracks how much of a resource we have, and the down operation waits for us to get that resource. And we can apply this pattern to many real scenarios where we want threads to wait for things. So with our library book example, our library has three copies. So if I want to take a copy, I call down to reserve it. That down returns, that means I am entitled to a copy. I know that when I go to grab that copy, it's going to be there because we're guaranteeing that we don't have too many people trying to get copies at once. And if all the copies are reserved, our semaphore, our number of free copies, will go to zero. And if someone asks to reserve a copy again, they'll wait until there's a copy returned. And when there's a copy returned, the person returning the copy will run the up operation, releasing a waiter and sort of handing off that copy implicitly to that thread that was waiting. So questions? How semaphores can represent when we want to wait, when we don't want to wait, and when we want to stop someone from waiting in this scenario. Yeah?
So as soon as the operation happens, does the waiter who's waiting in the waiting queue immediately get to call down and take a look, or does it happen?
So the question is, when the up operation happens, when does the thread that was calling down get to run? So the up operation is going to choose a particular thread that's calling down. And like consignal, it's going to make it runnable. That doesn't mean it gets to run right away. But it's going to get to run, and we'll choose that thread at that time. Does that answer your question? But it probably won't run right away. It'll probably run like when the scheduler gets to it. Like if we think of XV6's scheduler, you know, maybe the next timer interrupt. Other questions? Okay. So semaphores can implement a lot of common patterns we've seen. So one thing that semaphores can do is they can implement locks. So here's a mutex with a semaphore. We have a semaphore with an initial value of 1. And you can think of this as, if the value is 1, one thread can use the lock right now. When the value is 0, no threads can use the lock right now because it's already in use. So to lock the lock, we call down. We say, I want to reserve this lock. And to release the lock, we call up. I want to release a lock so one thread can use it. So questions? Yes, yeah.
So do they busy wait then? Like,
the question is, do semaphores busy wait? So a typical implementation of a semaphore will wait intelligently like mutexes do. But like with locks in general, the concept of semaphores doesn't actually specify how they wait. So you can have spin semaphores, which busy wait. The semaphores that POSIX provides are intelligently wait by putting the thread to sleep. Does that answer your question? Okay. So we can also implement joining threads with semaphores. And this is going to be probably our first case where this is going to look like a big advantage, or at least an advantage, over what we saw with condition variables. So I have this finish semaphore that's initially zero saying, no one waiting for me can complete. When I join, I call down on it. I'm saying, hey, I want to wait for this thread to finish. You know, I'm reserving this thread's book that the thread's going to return when it's done. And when the thread's done, it puts the book back. And note that this works no matter what order join and exit are called. If exit is called first, then the semaphore's value becomes 1. And when we call join later, it just completes immediately. We can decrement it without waiting for it to become positive because it's already positive. If we call join first, it waits for the exit. If we did this with condition variables, we'd have to get a lock and check the condition before we started waiting. Here, that's sort of all done in one operation for us. And that it works this way is why some people really prefer semaphores over monitors. Yes?
On the last slide, was that assuming that our count is 1? We have 1 book to check out?
So on this slide? So this is assuming the initial value is 1. And that is actually very important, right? The initial value. And here, the initial value is 0. Yes, and that is a very important part of making this work, is that you have to figure out what initial value makes sense. Okay, other questions? Okay, so POSIX has semaphores. And this is how they're used. So there's a seminit, takes a pointer to a semt that represents a semaphore and its initial value. So this is where you'll set the initial value. Then there's a wait and a post operation, wait for down, post for up, and a destroy. Seminit takes a process shared variable. To share the semaphore between processes, you'd have to figure out a way of having the same memory in two processes, which we haven't discussed how to do, but is possible. Some questions? Code. So now that we've seen semaphores, let's do something very simple with semaphores. So I have a put value and a get value function here. And the idea is that these functions sort of sync up with each other. So kind of like a mini, like two-thread barrier, or set of barriers, that put value and get value, you know, wait for, so get value is going to wait for the put value to happen and return the value, and then allow the next put value to happen. And because we need to get the value, we need to make sure put value doesn't happen again until we have the value actually retrieved. So the idea is that there's one call to get value per call to put value, and if I call put value twice in a row, the second call to put value won't happen until the call to get value completes in between. So we don't like lose a value. And I'm going to do this with two semaphores here. So one I've called empty and one I've called ready. And the idea is put value first waits for the empty semaphore. And the idea of that semaphore is that's going to be what get value used to say, I'm done getting the value, now you can put another value in. So the question is, you know, given this pattern, what code should go in the two blanks? You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree. Let me know if there's questions on sort of what the problem setup is here. Okay, so who wants more time? Okay, who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so most people think B, and this is what I concur with. So the way think about this is that before we get a value, we need put value to happen. And put value is doing something to try to signal us after it places a value, which is this sempost operation here. So we need something that's going to actually cause to wake up. Because like what the case we have to worry about is if get value gets called before put value happens, that put value should wake up the get value. So that means that this needs to be a wait on ready. And put value at the beginning, it waits for a signal from get value that, hey, I'm done getting the value, now you can put in another value. So for that, we have our this wait on empty here, and that needs to be signaled by the code after we get the value, so that's going to be post on empty. Yes?
Isn't there a deadlock here unless you initialize empty?
So the question, isn't there a deadlock here unless we initialize empty? Yes. So we have to initialize empty and ready to the correct values for this to work. And I didn't say how they were initialized. So there must be code which calls semi-init, which is required regardless of what the initial value is. And it is very important that that code set the correct initial values. So what? So you're saying the initial value for empty, what should it be? One. And what should it be for ready? Zero. Yes. And the way we can think of this is that initially, it should be the case that put value should work right away. That's why the initial value for empty needs to be one. And get value shouldn't work right away. That's why the initial value should be zero. So that, and that's how we can reason about what those should be. So questions? About what I did here. So something worth noting that's going to come up in the future is that this code is basically producer-consumer with a one-element buffer. So we're going to extend this to do producer-consumer with more elements. It's going to be the same kind of pattern. Now, generally, when using a semaphore, the way I like thinking about it is think about what you need to wait for. Is it like a critical section to be finished? Is it a queue to be done empty? Is it a ray to have space? Something like that. These are queue and rays, examples for producer-consumer. And then once you've thought of what you're waiting for, count something that's going to be zero when you need to wait. So for the critical section, you're counting the number of threads that can start the critical section now. So our mutex, we said it should be initially one, because when no one's running the critical section, one thread can start it now. Not two, just one. And when a thread's running the critical section, no threads can start it now. Which is why we decrement to get it. And we saw with join, we had this thing with that was initially zero, became one. That's the number of threads that can join without waiting. So when we wanted to wait, it was zero. When we didn't want to wait, it's one, or high. And for a queue to be non-empty, we want to have the number of items in the queue, like the number of books in the library. And if we want to wait for empty space, our semaphore represents the number of empty spaces. So that empty semaphore was one when the value had an empty space, zero otherwise. We were counting the number of empty spaces available. And the ready semaphore was counting the number of ready spaces available. It was one when the single value was ready, zero otherwise. So this sort of intuition can help you figure out how to set up a semaphore or set of semaphores for your problem. Okay, so questions? Yeah. Question, what's the difference between semaphore and tracking this with an integer? The semaphore's down operation does the waiting for you, and the up operation undoes it. So it's just precisely you're tracking it, but you want to do the waiting. Okay, so with this in mind, let's look at how we construct producer-consumer. So here I have producer-consumer, and let's think of what do I need to wait for? The consumer waits for producers if the buffer is full. The producer waits for consumers if the buffer, consumer waits if the buffer is empty. The producer waits if the buffer is full. And any thread waits while another thread's manipulating the buffer because, you know, we have to have agreement on when things are changing. So I'll add a semaphore for each of those conditions. So I need to say, have a wait if the buffer is empty. So I'll count the number of slots in the buffer. When that's zero, I need to wait. Number of used slots, hence full slots. I need to wait if the buffer is full. So I'll count the number of free spaces in the buffer. When that's zero, the buffer is full. I need to wait. And I also need to make sure only one thread manipulates the buffer at a time. So I'll have a mutex, which will be one or zero, and my buffer. Questions? Now, since I figured out what these full slots and empty slots are counting, I use semaphores to maintain that count correctly. So in my produce, I say, reserve an empty slot. That's my first operation. And once I've reserved an empty slot, I make sure I can access the buffer exclusively to make sure enqueue works correctly, enqueue an item and dequeue it. And enqueue an item, and then say, okay, now I have a full slot, and tell the producers about it by incrementing the number of full slots. So I'm doing bookkeeping. How many empty slots are there? Well, there's one less now. I haven't filled it yet, but it's reserved for me. And that's what that first wait does. And when I'm done filling it, I say, I filled it. Now someone else can start using that slot. And the consume side is wait for a full slot, reserve it. And once I've reserved it, I know I can dequeue safely because I reserved something to dequeue. And after I've dequeued it, I know I freed up space, so I say, there's now an empty slot that someone else can reserve. Okay, some questions? About this producer-consumer code. Full and empty slots. So one question here, can I reverse the order of these two operations? Someone shaking your head, you have an answer, explanation, or?
I think it could, because if you acquire the mutex and they're dissipated on the queue isn't empty, then no one else is going to be able to dequeue from it.
Yeah, so we can't do that because people can't remove things from the queue when we have the mutex. In particular, someone could be stuck in consume right here, have reserved a slot to dequeue, but we'll never get a chance to dequeue it if we do that. So the order of the waits, we have to be careful, make sure we're being consistent about that. This is deadlock, which we'll talk about probably Thursday. Okay. How about reordering the post? This we can do because post never waits. So it doesn't wait, doesn't matter what order we do it in. We don't have to worry about things waiting forever. Okay. So questions about producer-consumer? I'll have my summary here. Let's wait. So we have empty and full slots, just tracking the number of empty slots and full slots in our buffer. And that's sort of most of how we make the synchronization work. And this seems kind of elegant with this, and this is why people like counting semaphores like this. Okay. Questions? Okay. So one minor note on other types of semaphores. So we talked about what are called counting semaphores, which keep an integer that's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to some large number. You'll also sometimes see what are known as binary semaphores, which are semaphores that are only 0 or 1. And you might say, gosh, those seem kind of useless. But it turns out that with a set of binary semaphores and some variables, you can implement counting semaphores. So in that sense, they're equally powerful. Now, I'm teaching counting semaphores because I find them easier to understand, but you can implement one with the other. Okay. And I'll skip over, I have a slide with an implementation, but we'll skip over that for time. Okay, so we talked about semaphores. Now, our textbook, Anderson Dahlin, doesn't like semaphores. Our view is that programming with locks and condition variables is superior to programming with semaphores. They just don't like them. So their arguments are that it's clearer to have separate constructs for waiting and critical sections and blocking, which is what condition variables in NewTexas do. And their other argument is that they think semaphores are trickier to reason about because you have to be really careful about verifying that your ups and downs match, where, as we learned with condition variables, you can kind of be sloppy. You can say while something, check it, and you don't have to worry about, am I broadcasting exactly the right number of times? If you broadcast extra times, signal extra times, it's no big deal. If you post extra times with semaphores, well, the count's wrong, so it is a big deal. On the other hand, we have like annoyances we have to deal with with NewTexas and condition variables, which don't come up with semaphores, like needing to double check the condition. Okay. Now, I note that though Anderson Dahlin prefers locks and condition variables, they're equally powerful. And how can we prove they're equally powerful? Well, we can implement one with the other. So let's implement monitors with semaphores. Start with locks. Here's a lock. We saw that already. So semaphore initially 1, lock decrement to 0, unlock increment to 1. OK. Now, condition variables, those are trickier. And they seem really tricky because of this issue that if we do the straightforward thing of having our weight, just do a semaphore weight, do a semaphore up or down rather, then this hypothetical signal implementation wakes up threads which aren't waiting yet. And that's something we expect condition variables not to do. When we call consignal, it only wakes up things that are waiting right now. It doesn't like wake up something that starts waiting, 10 minutes later. With semaphores, that's how this works. So how can we fix that? So it's not entirely obvious how to fix. And we're going to use this trick that's going to come up several times that we're just going to track how many people are waiting. So my wait and signal implementation, I'm going to track how many are waiting and when I have a private lock. A lock just for this condition variable implementation. So my wait operation is going to increment the number of waiters and then wait on the semaphore. And because I know how many waiters there are from signal, the signal now can skip incrementing the semaphore if no one's actually waiting for it. And I have this private lock to ensure that that number of threads that are waiting for it is actually consistent. Okay, some questions? This sort of strategy of track who's waiting, then do something, we're going to see again. And if I'm tracking the number of waiting, now I can also implement broadcast. I just keep upping the semaphore until I've handled all the waiters I have recorded. So questions? The question is, why do I lock and unlock around this weight here in the weight function? And the reason for that is because the way condition variable weight was defined, is that it unlocks the lock while you're waiting and relocks it when you're done waiting. And so that's just implementing that part of how condition variables work. Yes? My question is, how does this keep track of which threads are waiting? It does not. We're just relying on knowing how many are waiting, and we know that the post operation here will wake up that number of threads exactly. And that's why it's okay. Okay. Other questions? Yeah, so I guess I should mention, to completely answer your question, it could be the case that the thread that incremented num waiters isn't the one that finishes waiting, and that's okay. Okay, so this is showing that we can implement monitors with semaphores. We can also go in the other direction. We can implement semaphores with monitors. So I have a monitor, I'm gonna have a lock to protect my state. My state's gonna be a count that's never negative. And I'm gonna have a condition variable to wait for the count to be positive, because he said down waits for the count to be positive, then decrements it. So here's my wait for the count to be positive condition variable. So my down operation is while the count isn't positive, wait, then decrement the count. And my up operation is increment the count, signal the condition variable. Okay, so questions? Thanks. And I can safely use signal because I know each time I increment the count, I'm letting at most one thread go. Any questions about? Okay. Now I'll skip over that here. We'll maybe go back to that exercise later. Great. Okay, so talked about semaphores and condition variables and as sort of general synchronization constructs, and we looked at producer-consumer as one sort of example of a common synchronization pattern we can solve with both of them. I'm going to look at another common synchronization pattern, which is the reader-writer problem, that we have some shared data that only one thread can modify at a time, but read-only access for multiple threads is safe. So this is a really common situation. I have some list that doesn't change very often, so lots of things can read it, but when it does change, you can't be reading it while it changes or else you'll get confused. Like you'll read part of the changed value but not the whole changed value, and you won't know what to do. So we could use a lock, but that doesn't allow multiple readers. So there's this abstraction that's going to allow multiple readers called a reader-writer lock. So this is going to be a lock that distinguishes between readers and writers. So we're going to have a read lock that waits until there's no writers. We're going to have a read lock operation that waits until there's no writers, and a corresponding unlock, which stops being registered as a reader. But there's also going to be a write lock operation that waits until there's no readers or writers, and an unlock. So the way we can think about this is that this is like a lock, but we can have, you know, 1,000 read locks at once, or one write lock. But not any, you know, we can't have a write lock in anyone else. So the write lock is a really an exclusive lock, and the read lock you can kind of share with all the other readers. But it's one lock, so we ensure that we have, you know, exclusive writes, but not exclusive reads. Okay. So questions on what this provides? It's abstraction. So this is sort of a generalization of locks to handle this multiple readers should be allowed at once problem. And POSIX, in fact, provides a reader-writer lock implementation called RW locks. So there's a read lock and unlock, write lock and unlock. And presumably remembers which type of lock you did. But this is something we could have implemented ourselves, if POSIX didn't, with monitors or semaphores. So let's look at implementing it with monitors. So I'm going to have a lock to protect my state. What state do I want to track? And let's figure that out. Let's look here. So I want to wait until there's no readers or and no writers. What should I track to know that? So I want to wait till there's no readers or writers. I'm going to track how many readers or writers there are. So this is the same trick you saw with tracking the number of waiters. Here we're tracking how many readers, how many writers are there. And I know I have two different conditions that I wait for. I wait for the read lock to be available, so I might need to wait to get a read lock. I wait for the write lock to be available. So I have a read, okay to read condition, okay to write condition. These are queues of threads waiting to read and waiting to write. And so here's my implementation. So I'll walk through this. So for read lock, we lock the mutex. And while there's at least one writer, we have to wait. When there isn't any writers, we increment the number of readers, and we're done. And unlocking, we decrement the number of readers. And if there's no readers, it might be the case that someone could write, so we would tell them that. For write locking, we have to wait until there's no readers or writers. So while the number of readers or writers is not zero, readers and writers together, we wait, then we decrement the number of writers. And when we're done, either a reader or writer could go. So I wake up any writers and also all the readers in case there's no writers. Okay. So waking up all readers when no writers, and waking up writers when there's no readers. Waking up one writer when there's no readers. Okay, some questions about how this code works. So the question is, why do we signal end broadcast only one should be necessary? So this is indeed a problem. And so what we're doing here is we're saying, I don't know if there's people are waiting to read or write, because readers and writers, remember, is the people actually reading and writing, not the people in the loop waiting. And therefore, I'm just doing both, and someone's going to get the lock first. So this is not a very satisfying solution. So next time, we're going to talk about how can we make an explicit choice here. That right now, I'm just saying, we're going to wake them all up, and someone's going to get the lock first, someone's going to get to read or write. But we'd actually like to choose. But to do that, we need to know, well, is there someone writing who wants to write or not? We don't know that right now. That's where I'll finish today.